I'm very pleased to introduce our guest speaker, Lee Ward. Lee Ward is Alpha Sigma Nu Distinguished Associate Professor at Campion College and teaches in the Department of Political Science at the University of Regina. He received his BA honors from the University of Toronto, an MA from Brock University, and a PhD in Political Science from Fordham University in New York City. He previously taught in the Department of Political Science at Kenyon College in Gambia, Ohio, and was the Bradley Postdoctoral Fellow in the program in Constitutional Government at Harvard University. His research and teaching interests are the history of political philosophy, early modern and American political thought, liberal constitutional theory, political philosophy, and democratic theory. Lee is the author of John Locke and Modern Life, The Politics of Liberty in England and the Revolutionary America, and co-edited with Dr. Anne Ward, the Ashgate Research Companion to Federalism. He has also written journal articles on John Locke, Aristotle, Montesquieu, Algernon Sidney, and Plato. Thank you very much, Lee.
Thank you and good morning. Before I begin, I'd like to thank the congregation for inviting me to speak to you this morning. I've long thought of Unitarianism as a beacon of intellectual probity and rational engagement in questions surrounding the relation of religion, ethics, morality, and even politics. As such, I'm honored to be here. Thank you. Thomas Jefferson is well known as one of the greatest champions of the Enlightenment philosophy in the American founding period. His vision of a natural rights republic-based democratic republic famously placed special emphasis on the importance of religious toleration and rational examination of all moral, political, and scientific questions. What is less widely known, however, is Jefferson's foray into the field of biblical criticism in the later part of his life with the production of his, quote, The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, extracted textually from the Gospels in Greek, Latin, French, and English. At that time, they weren't into pithy titles, so that was kind of typical. In this remarkable work, Jefferson compiled his own version of the Gospel, drawn from extracts literally cut and pasted, and not with a mouse, literally cut with scissors and pasted by hand, cut and pasted portions from the four evangelists. While the actual words hold the acknowledged authority of Scripture, the organizing noose behind the compilation is unquestionably Jefferson. Today I want to illuminate the relation between Jefferson, the Enlightenment apostle of political liberty on one hand, and Jefferson, the biblical commentator and de facto religious teacher on the other. I argue that Jefferson's version of the gospel signified his attempt to construct what he took to be a coherent narrative about the life of Jesus that would be consistent with a vision of a natural rights-based democratic society. Jefferson's Jesus is an Enlightenment figure par excellence, a political and social reformer who challenged and was ultimately destroyed by the reactionary forces of throne and altar, but whose example and ethical teaching remains an inspiration to modern Democrats. In the process, Jefferson limned the features of a democratized theology shorn of practically all of the mystical, metaphysical, and supernatural elements of the Gospels that Jefferson believed contradicted human reason and sound morality. Jefferson suggests that this minimalist doctrine provides the ground for a tolerant version of Christianity that amounted to what I take to be Jefferson's blueprint for a democratic civil religion in the young American Republic. Before we get into the meat of Jefferson's Bible, first a few words about the background to his religious thought. Brought up in the established Anglican Church in colonial Virginia, Jefferson turned to 18th century freethinkers as a young adult, from Bolingbroke in particular, young Jefferson absorbed scathing criticism of the biblical tradition, and he admired Bolingbroke's judgment that ancient Greek and Roman philosophy was a far superior ethical teaching to that of Christianity. Arguably, this was Jefferson's own judgment of Christianity prior to his introduction to the work of the prominent English radical Joseph Priestley. Priestley's voluminous A History of the Corruptions of Christianity, which Jefferson obtained in the mid-1790s, argued that the pure ethical teaching of Jesus had been corrupted by the influence of later doctrinaires, most particular St. Paul, who built up a massive ecclesiastical structure upon what was originally a very simple but very powerful moral teaching. His exposure to Priestley's work was probably the turning point in Jefferson's development, for in Priestley, he was first introduced to Jesus as a moral teacher and social reformer. This is the Jesus that would emerge in his own scriptural exegesis. The new dispensation that characterized Jefferson's religious thought during his presidency and post-political career perhaps first emerged in his what came to be known as the Syllabus of an Estimate of the Merits of the Doctrines of Jesus Compared with Others. This was written in 1803 in response to a series of requests from his old revolutionary comrade, Dr. Benjamin Rush. Rush, stung by Federalist charges in the 1800 presidential election that his old friend was an atheist, pleaded with Jefferson to please explain your feelings about Christianity. Jefferson reveals in the syllabus that in any contest between ancient pagans and Jews on the one hand and Jesus of the Gospels on the other, as to the superior ethical and moral teaching, Jefferson unequivocally gave the advantage to Jesus. In contrast to what he took to be the parochialism of ancient pagans and degraded ideas about God among the Jews, Jefferson claims to find in Jesus' teaching, quote, a system of morals the most perfect and sublime that has ever been taught by man, unquote. The syllabus marks Jefferson's confidence in the moral progress of humanity. It also showed for the first time Jefferson's willingness to reflect deeply upon the significance of Jesus' life and career as a teacher, as opposed to Jesus, the miraculous spokesman of a particular church or sect. In the months after writing the syllabus, Jefferson began his first effort to construct an intellectual portrait of Jesus drawn from selections taken from the Gospels. But this work, which he entitled The Philosophy of Jesus of Nazareth, and which he apparently distributed among his cabinet and to his daughters, a very select group, it was lost from historical record after Jefferson's death, so we don't know what it contained. But, fortunately, 14 years later, Jefferson embarked upon making an expanded version of it, which became the Jefferson Bible. Completed in 1820, the actual text is 85 numbered leaves, with Greek and Latin text mounted on the left-hand page, and French and English on the right-hand page. Sections of scripture, again, were literally cut and pasted onto blank pages by Jefferson in a new arrangement, and then bound in red leather. It also included two small maps of fold-out maps of Palestine and Asia Minor at the time, in biblical times. Appreciating the Jefferson Bible is a tactile experience, so I would like to let you all have a look and feel of it in the Smithsonian edition published in 2011. Apart from the editor's introduction, this is pretty much what the original would have been. You could please just take it in. Have a look and hand it around. Two features of Jefferson's Bible immediately draw the reader's attention. First, Jefferson's clear intention is to remove all aspects of the gospel that represent what he took to be the corruptions of Christianity. Central to Jefferson's study of scriptural exegesis was the assumption that the Bible should be read in an historical and critical way, just as, he suggested, one would read Livy or Tacitus, the classical historians. Gone from Jefferson's arrangement is any suggestion of Jesus' divinity or miraculous powers. As Jefferson sought to excise all the, quote, Platonic mysteries that he believed had been used for centuries to confound and obscure the simple and powerful ethical teaching of Jesus. Jefferson's Jesus does not rise from the dead. Indeed, the closing verse in Jefferson's Bible is, quote, "There they laid Jesus and rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulcher and departed." The end. To say the least, it becomes a very different story when you put a different ending. To Jefferson, much of what Christianity had become in the hands of sectarians and theologians was mere demonism, represented most clearly in the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, miracles, resurrection, the ascension, the Eucharistic corporeal presence, the Trinity, and the doctrine of original sin. Thus, the first impression to which the reader has to adjust one's vision is that of a Jesus who is an inspired teacher, as well as a political and social reformer, but who is also very much a human being and is not the Son of God. The second striking feature of Jefferson's Bible lies in the arrangement of the text itself. In presenting the scriptural text in a quadrilingual arrangement, Jefferson subtly rejected the more common approach to scriptural exegesis at the time, which was known as the harmonies of the four Gospels format, which arranged the text of the Gospels in parallel columns side by side for purposes of comparison. So what did Matthew say at this point? What did Mark say at this point? What did Luke say? Rather than employ this format to highlight discrepancies and variations among the Gospels, Jefferson reproduced his own, what I would call a mosaic version, in four different languages. So there are two features of the text that I would ask you to help me understand. First, why did Jefferson include these four languages? Greek, Latin, French, English. Second, why a single condensed version rather than the standard four approved Gospels? I'll conclude with my own tentative interpretations, and I would welcome your input as well. In order to appreciate the radical nature of Jefferson's demystified Jesus, it's good to recall what it is that Jefferson chose to omit from his account. In the first instance, we see Jefferson's decision to commence his narrative at Luke chapter 2 with the pronouncement, "And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed." Gone is any suggestion of the miraculous birth recounted in Luke 1 and Matthew 1. Lacking angelic visitations and lengthy genealogies, Jefferson's Jesus is simply a precocious Jewish child born into a remote corner of the Roman Empire. The first actual story of Jesus' life that Jefferson chooses to highlight is his disobedience of his parents when he stayed behind in the synagogue in Jerusalem when he was 12 years old. Jefferson relates Luke's insistence on the young Jesus' intellectual powers. Quote, "And all that heard him were astonished at his understanding and his answers." Notably, Jefferson omits any reference to Jesus' cheeky claim about seeing to his real father's business in the temple, that is, as the Son of God, rather than the son of Joseph, the carpenter. We also see this tendency in Jefferson's selections relating to John the Baptist, in which the entire direct relation between Jesus and John is contained in four verses and culminates in Matthew 3:13. "Then cometh Jesus from Galilee to Jordan unto John to be baptized of him." Jefferson omits the famous exchange wherein John predicts the coming of the Messiah and his own unworthiness to tie the promised one's sandals. Likewise, Jefferson cuts out any reference to the miraculous nature of Jesus' baptism, such as Matthew 3:16, where we are told of Jesus that the heavens were opened up unto him, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and lighting upon him. Shorn of its miraculous and prophetic qualities, Jefferson's account of Jesus' baptism relies entirely on the logical connection between the idea of Jesus' increase in wisdom and stature as a teacher and his personal commitment to a life of preaching, symbolized by his baptism. So Jesus is the thinker turned activist. So much of what has historically come to define Jesus' life and mission is removed from Jefferson's Bible. Jesus never casts out any devils or heals the lame. In lieu of miracles, Jefferson's Jesus demonstrates his goodness by virtue of the salutary and edificatory nature of his moral teaching. Throughout Jefferson's version of the text, the reader is reminded that all of Jesus' auditors, even his enemies, acknowledge that he taught as one with authority. He was smart. The core of Jesus' moral teaching in the Jefferson Bible is a selection of classical parables, including the Good Samaritan, the adulterous story, the prodigal son, the servants in the vineyard, and the Sermon on the Mount. The common thread running through these stories and homilies is the theme of forgiveness, humility, and a recognition of basic human equality. Jesus' preaching of concern for others contains frequent and explicit repudiations of sectarian and partisan loyalties that he believed would efface one's sense of our moral obligations to other human beings. What we see in Jefferson's Jesus is a champion of political and social reform who drew great multitudes to him by virtue of his teaching directed to encouraging social cooperation, but importantly, the elimination of sectarian rivalry and prejudices. Jesus' recurring battles with the Pharisees reflects Jefferson's belief that the natural tendency of religion throughout history has been to, unfortunately, create conflict among people. In many respects, Jesus is to the Pharisees what Jefferson saw himself to be in relation to the agents of the established churches in his own time, who warned their followers in the 1800 election that a future President Jefferson would confiscate their Bibles. So President Obama was not the first to face that charge. Jefferson's Jesus confronts the Pharisees on both their distorted conception of good works and their proclivity to interfere with normal social intercourse, all for the sake of reinforcing sectarian prejudices. No less than three of the episodes that Jefferson chooses to highlight the conflict between Jesus and the Pharisees has to do with Jesus dining at the home of a Pharisee. In these stories taken from Matthew, Luke, and Mark, Jesus is criticized by the Pharisees after accepting an invitation to dine with them, either because he did not wash himself properly or because he allowed an unclean woman to join in the meal. The portrait of the Pharisees that Jefferson constructs is that of a group of malevolent fanatics who are obsessed with bodily functions and will try to find any excuse to interrupt normal social interaction with their dogmatic fetishes. Jesus then stands again as a progenitor of the Enlightenment ideal to which Jefferson himself aspired. Jefferson's Jesus is also, like Jefferson, a shrewd politician who learns from the effects of John the Baptist's imprudence. The iconoclastic John was destroyed arguably before he really could even begin his ministry. Jesus is wary and wilier. Notably, Jesus' caution throughout the Jefferson Bible is directly connected to the status of Jerusalem in the larger narrative. This Jesus is defined in opposition to the center of political and religious power. This oppositional relation evolves throughout the text, with Jesus' relative safety and security in Galilee contrasted sharply with the intrinsic danger and hostility of Judea. Specifically, Jerusalem is cast as the seductive but corrupt co-conspirator in Jesus' demise. Beyond the relative security of Galilee is a world of Pharisee plots and conspiracies to entrap Jesus. These agents of privilege and sectarian pride constantly tested Jesus' prudence. While Jefferson's de-divinized Jesus does not get into trouble for healing the lame on the Sabbath, he nonetheless has many occasions in which he chides the Pharisees for callously countenancing human suffering rather than perform works on the Sabbath. Jefferson's Jesus is a politically savvy reformer whose eventual destruction at the hands of the established power of throne and altar is designed to encourage free thinking and excoriate cynical hypocrisy are what Jefferson took to be cynical hypocrisy of political and religious elites. However, in one crucial respect, Jefferson's Jesus does retain a very traditional aspect of Christian theology, namely the conception of an afterlife. This is striking because while on the one hand Jefferson omits any reference to Jesus' resurrection, or indeed anything subsequent to his burial, Jefferson also selected practically every instance in all four of the Gospels when Jesus threatened eternal pain to evildoers and reward for the just. The Jesus of Jefferson's Bible is far from being a bloodless rationalist or dry logician. He is at times a thundering preacher who clearly saw an important role for divine judgment to support morality. Jefferson's Jesus recounts with great aplomb the eternal rewards of the good and the torments of the wicked. While it may be true that Jefferson rejected the orthodox teaching on hell constructed by centuries of doctrine, he nonetheless clearly wanted to preserve a palpable sense of the idea of punishment in his own version of the Gospels. Jefferson repeatedly intones about those left behind on Judgment Day, quote, two men shall be in the field, the one shall be taken, the other left. Jefferson also retained the mini apocalypse in Matthew 24:25, in which Jesus warns that God will come to divideth the sheep from the goats. We are told there will be a day of judgment in which there will be wailing and gnashing of teeth. In the midst of all this fire and brimstone, Jefferson even uncharacteristically allows his narrative to be infiltrated by mystical images of angels and references to the Son of Man, superstitions otherwise normally purged from his text. How are we to understand Jefferson's apparently atavistic use of divine judgment in a text largely devoid of mysticism? Clearly, Jefferson saw this aspect of the Gospels as a vital element in his project to reconceive religion in terms of support for morality and decent human conduct. Notably, Jefferson's definition of wrongdoers who will be punished, as well as those who will be rewarded, is rooted in behavior rather than belief. The hypocritical Pharisees, the usual targets of Jesus' admonitions, are threatened with eternal punishment not because of what they believe, but because of what they do or fail to do, their fellow human beings. In part, the images of divine punishment are meant to convey the idea that righteousness is the narrow path and requires continual reaffirmation through good works. Jefferson's point also, however, seems to be similar to that of the great English philosopher John Locke, who argued that the basic hedonic calculation about fear of pain and hope for a reward is a vital supplement to moral virtue for most people who simply lack the leisure or the mental capacity for deep theological ponderings. Either way, the fear that this vestigial belief in the afterlife could become a permanent source of superstition would presumably be one of the challenges Jefferson hoped would be successfully confronted by encouraging scientific investigation and religious freedom in democratic society. To conclude with the two questions I raised earlier, why the four languages? While there's no clear evidence that Jefferson intended his Bible for anything but his own private use, there's also nothing that forecloses the possibility that he may have seen a role for his Bible in shaping American attitudes towards religion. As a living legend, Jefferson was keenly aware that everything he wrote and everything he owned would have significance in the young republic. The writing table in which he composed the Declaration of Independence, he donated to the American Museum of History, knowing that it would be, quote, in his own words, a relic. The four languages, then, might suggest that his audience is broader than simply the Republic of Letters. For while Greek and Latin may provide for reasons of scholarship, English and French are the vernacular tongue of the two peoples Jefferson felt were most responsible for advancing democracy in the world as a historical movement, the Americans and the French. Why the single narrative? I submit that Jefferson eschewed the heuristic models of scriptural exegesis because his goal is not to elucidate the Gospels, but rather to replace them with a rationalized version purged of most of its internal contradictions and mystifications. The single text could provide the anchor for a new religious dispensation built around a new idea of Jesus, a new Reformed Christianity. This de-divinized Jesus was a staple of the Unitarian strand of American Christianity in Jefferson's time. Jefferson's admiration for Unitarianism was well known. Jefferson famously predicted, quote, "I confidently expect that the present generation will see Unitarianism become the general religion of the United States." Now, not all of his predictions turned out to be true. But in this light, it is perhaps not beyond the realm of possibility that Jefferson may have hoped that his Bible could become a model for a kind of Unitarian scripture that could be distributed among the public, but especially among the educated young men in the seminaries and universities, most particularly Jefferson's beloved University of Virginia, which he founded. These would be the next generation of leaders of American democracy. In this way, Jefferson, who was never one to hide his light under a bushel, may have reserved to himself the enormous task of replacing the venerable, but in his view, radically defective, council-created New Testament, which was produced in a backward and barbaric epoch, and would be replaced with his own, more compact, rational, and socially beneficial offering designed for a democratic age. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lee. That was very interesting. For me, personally, it was... I had never known about Jefferson, so this is all new. So we'll give this time, a short time for people to make comments.
Would you have any comments about the result when you look at what is happening in the United States today, particularly among the Republicans?
It is. Jefferson deplored sectarianism. He deplored the overt involvement of clergy in politics. He personally felt aggrieved at ministers who informed their congregations to vote against him in the 1800 election because he had championed religious liberty. He felt that was a complete betrayal of the real principles of American Republic and also of Christianity. So I think Jefferson, although he's been appropriated in some respects by the political right in America for other reasons, I think he would be very concerned at a new kind of theological a movement that seems to have hijacked a big part of one of the political parties. In fact, if you go to Washington, D.C., we all know the Washington Monument, the wonderful obelisk, and the Lincoln Monument. Another great monument that isn't as well known, I think, is the Jefferson Monument. It's just on the other side of the Tidewater. And it was built in the 1940s. And if you go and look at it, I think you'd find that they couldn't build that monument today. There would be far too much political controversy because the quotations inside the dome are references to religious freedom and toleration and the separation of church and state. So I actually find it hard to believe that you could build the Jefferson Monument today, because that argument would be, at least to a certain segment of the political parties, would be objectionable. That's a good point, though. Thanks.
It seems from your presentation that Jefferson's research was strictly into the Bible and various interpretations in history of what happened. Was there any research based on archaeology or outside the Bible that he relied on to come to his conclusions?
I think there was. It was fairly rudimentary at that stage. It's really sort of the 19th century. You start to, particularly with the German scholarship, the reexamination, the archaeological aspects. I think he relied primarily on the work of Joseph Priestley, the great English intellectual. And he, I think, had either done the research or had drawn on different archaeological research. Jefferson would have loved it, though. Yeah. He would have loved the later developments in religious studies and biblical criticism and analysis. I think he would have enjoyed getting involved in that. And the other thing about Jefferson, too, is he was also an eclectic scholar in terms of religious studies and comparative studies. Jefferson's Quran, he purchased the Quran, I think, in the 1780s. And it's a real source of interest because it wasn't well known among Americans at that point. And he studied it and drew what he thought were many really valuable lessons from the Quran. And again, this is something that becomes politically controversial later when there are the idea of Jefferson would have tolerated Islam in the 1780s or 1790s after 9/11 became kind of unpatriotic in some respects. But Jefferson had a copy of the Quran. It's well annotated. He would have loved to have pursued further research into it as well. He did. I don't think he read Hebrew. I don't think that might have been an obstacle for him, but he did have the Greek and the Latin and the French, and the Greek would give him access to the Koine, so he would have had a kind of template for reading the Old Testament through the Greek.
Is there any record of Unitarians at the time, their reaction, if they had a chance to get to it, to see his Bible?
Yeah, it would have been later. It would have been the 1890s. So, because the history of the Bible, it stayed in Jefferson's family, and it made an appearance. It was actually a Jewish family in Baltimore, the Cohens, who had purchased the Bibles that he had used to cut out the passages. So we had these wonderful old Bibles with these parts missing. And it was a curator at the Smithsonian who first came across these Bibles, and he asked the Cohens, well, what's the story behind this? And they said, well, the president had created his own Bible. So they went to the family, and it was Jefferson's great-granddaughter, Randolph, and she sold it, I think, for $400 to the Smithsonian in the 1890s. At which point, then, I think many Unitarians would have been fascinated by it and would have loved to. But at the time, it wasn't public knowledge at the time. No.
Thank you. Just one last question.
Sure.
Thank you.
Hey, Chris.
He portrayed Jesus as a normal human being with good character and morality. Usually, sometimes we build good character and morality through mistakes that we've made in our past. Does he ever talk about any shortcomings of Jesus as a human?
That's a good question. I'm trying to think what there would have been in the text. I guess the disobedience of his parents when he was 12 years old. He stayed behind in Jerusalem. Although, it's a curious kind of fault because it's also born out of your curiosity and born out of his sort of natural intellect. There is the anger. You do see Jesus driving the money changers out of the temple. And again, though, I'm not sure that's a failing in one sense, but it's also born out of a kind of righteous indignation on the other. He didn't add anything to the text, so he's just using the four Gospels. And I'm trying to think where there would be better kind of indications of sort of basic human frailty and Jesus learning from his mistakes. I think in the larger sense, the way Jefferson edits it, he seems to present Jesus as learning from John the Baptist. The relation with John the Baptist is interesting. And John is too outspoken. John is too much, he's a direct challenge to the political elites, and he's going to be destroyed. So Jesus seems to learn from this, and he's warier and a little more careful. And the sense is that John never really had a chance to get his ministry off the ground, whereas Jesus is going to take a little more time and get that. Again, whether that's a mistake or not, it's learning in some respects. It's learning. If Jefferson had written his own gospel from scratch, that would really be interesting. Mm-hmm. It would have been, I think, maybe more Colorado. Ben Franklin writing, that would be wonderful. I'd like to see that. But it's a good question.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.